we give thanks for this precious day, for those gathered here and those far away, for the time we share with love and care. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Michaela Sievers, a member here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I sing in the choir, serve on the music committee, and will be representing our fellowship at the Unitarian Universalist Association's Midwest Leadership School next month. We gather here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan not because we think we are all the same, but because we are enriched by discovering and celebrating how we all are unique and different. As a liberal religious community, we respect and embrace people of all backgrounds and identities. I invite you now to take a moment and say hello to those around you. So I expect that many of you maybe met someone new this morning, and that's always great to see new faces. Are there any guests that would like to introduce themselves willingly? Yeah.
Sorry, I guess this is another moment, perhaps teaching moment. So out of respect for anybody who's hard of hearing, we always try to speak into the microphone. So sorry about that if you don't like talking into a microphone. But thanks to our wonderful guest minister today, the word got out to some Mandela fellows who are being hosted on the K-State campus by the School of Leadership Studies. And so we have three guests here and then a whole bunch of other local guests that I think they trailed along with them. So I'll at least let four or five of our guests here introduce themselves. So we've got Ricardo, Stu, and Patrick, and I'll let you say what you do back home and what country you're from, and then I'm sure you'll be swamped with people who want to talk to you after the service. So.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Ricardo. I am from Namibia, and I'm a geotechnical supervisor working for a uranium mine.
Hello.
Hi.
I didn't expect to be put on the spot. My name is Stu. I come from a country called Zambia. Back home, I'm a medical journalist who works for a pediatric hospital whose headquarters is actually in the U.S., and we deal with kids with different types of disability. So I'm very happy to be here, and everybody has been amazing, and I'm excited to find out what happens here today.
Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Miller. I am from Zimbabwe. I'm a writer and performing artist.
Oh, sorry. I know some of you guys. I'm Lucas Siebert, and I'm a local, and I'm a case manager at Big Lakes for individuals with developmental disabilities. That's my roommate, Hannah. She doesn't want to talk.
Only if you want to. It's fine.
Hello, my name is Ivy Calvert. I'm also a local, and I just finished a degree in music at K-State.
Yeah, sure. My name is Alex Fees. I'm from Manhattan, and I'll be starting a master's program at K-State in next semester. Yeah.
Is there anyone else? Yeah, welcome.
Hi, Linda Krager. I want to introduce Dagan. He's going to be staying with Mike and I for a while, and I hope many of you will get to know him.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Hannah. We have Jamie, Caroline, and Sammy. Today we're from Big Lakes. We're just trying out some new churches, and I personally have been to a UU church in Wichita and also Minnesota and Seattle. So I'm excited to try out a new church, a new UU church.
All right. Is there anyone else who wants to step up and speak for a minute? We have a lot of new
faces. Yeah, well, I used to be a member here, but I am visiting, and it's wonderful to be back, see familiar faces and some new faces. So, yeah.
All
Aaron
right.
Ford, sorry, there's my name.
All right, so you heard him mentioned earlier, but this morning we have a guest speaker, Reverend David Jones from the Ecumenical Campus Ministry. David is about to begin his 20th year serving as campus pastor for the Ecumenical Campus Ministry at K-State. Married to Linda and father to Nathan, 26, and Lindsay, 25, he is a graduate of Augustana College, now known as Augustana University, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, St. Paul School of Theology in Kansas City, and Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Our topic this morning is searching for truth through service learning, and Reverend Jones will share his expertise as a director who is overseeing service learning trips. I'd like to draw your attention to the announcements in our bulletin. We have a thank you from the Progressive Summerfest, and that is just a special thank you to anyone who was at all involved in putting on our Progressive Summerfest on June 11th. Many hands sharing the load made it all possible. We also have a family fun trip that is available for everyone to Fort Riley, and I would encourage you all to go and visit the fort if you haven't ever been. I think I went when I was really little, but I don't remember it. So it's something that I think would be worthwhile. And you may be interested. All right, next we have our chalice lighting. And Michelle Hill and her family are going to come up for that. This is an interfaith benediction by Gary Kowalski. Gathered in our varied faiths, we give thanks for the blessings of world community as we share our common dream. Homes and schools where children thrive, neighborhoods that are safe and clean, a city rich in colors and cultures, an economy where no one is expendable, a beloved community where rich and poor alike have access to the opportunity for a dignified and productive life, churches, mosques, synagogues, and temples where our deepest hope is to be of service to a hurting world. Enable us as we leave this place to carry forth this prayer into the coming week, turning our thoughts towards charity, our hearts towards justice, and our hands toward the work of peace. Shalom and amen. Our opening hymn is number 118, and Michael Oldfather will be leading us on guitar. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing This Little Light of Mine.
We're going to sing the three verses that are written and a fourth one, which I'll give you. Then we'll go back and sing the first one because we like the song so much.
This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine. Everywhere I go, I'm gonna let it shine. Everywhere I go, I'm gonna let it shine. Everywhere I go, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Building up the world, I'm gonna let it shine. Building up the world, I'm gonna let it shine. Building up the world, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
hide it under a bushel, no. I'm gonna let it shine. Hide it under a bushel, no. I'm gonna let it shine. Hide it under a bushel, no. I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
All right, thank you, Michael. As a congregation, we are compassionate listeners who support each other through personal experiences and recognize that by sharing, our joys are magnified and sorrows diminish. If you have a brief personal joy or sorrow to share, please raise your hand and wait for the microphone.
Larry Weaver. I've been away for 3 weeks visiting with my wife, our granddaughter in Minnesota, and had a wonderful time. But I'm delighted to be back.
Hi, everybody. Molly McGoy again. We just had Buddy and Bobette's daughters, Karen and Rhonda, here for a wonderful week-long visit, which was great. And Nick goes to 4-H camp next week, where he will turn 12. And I will not see my child on his birthday, and I have mixed feelings about that. So
aww.
We'll let you know next week how it goes. But an early birthday wish for Nick.
That's a big birthday choir.
Ever since I've been in Big Lakes, I didn't think I'd like it. But now, since I've been in Big Lakes, I have many close friends, and now I have a job working in the hotel. So I'm so glad I'm in Big Lakes now instead of being in the hotel and been in the shelter. So. Jamie Chambers.
Congratulations. All right, I now invite the children to come forward as Reverend David leads us in a conversation for all ages. I think we only have a few.
Hey guys, come on over here.
Oh, you back then? Oh,
maybe I should.
You can sit in the chair if you like. Okay. That's fine.
Come on down. How's everybody doing today? Kind of tired. Yeah, kind of hot. It's been hot lately, hasn't it? Have you been spending time inside or outside? Both. Okay. I was outside last night. We had a party at my house, and we have lots of trees. And I just wondered, do you guys have a favorite, like, shade tree, like, when it's hot and you're outside? Do you have a, like, maybe this tree? That's a pretty cool tree, isn't it? There's a lot of shade made by that tree. Do you know, though, that that tree started out as a little teeny tiny seed? Did you realize that? I brought some seeds with me just so you could kind of get a sense for how these are actually pepper seeds, but that's well. But here you can each have you can have a seed there. So you can see your hand out there. Yeah. Oh, there you go. How many I got? Oh, I'm almost out. There. Now, let's see. Is there one left? Oh, you might. Oh, she got one. Good. All right. Very good. So that's what happens when we plant seeds. They go into the ground and something wonderful happens, and they are transformed into first small trees, and then they grow up to be big trees. And when they get to be big trees, what's really cool about it is that they get, like this tree, they can give shade on hot summer days to people who pass by, and sometimes they provide homes. What kind of animals do you think live in trees?
Raccoons.
Yeah, they like to climb in trees. Squirrels, yeah. What else?
Birds.
Birds, yeah. all kinds of animals live in trees, and the trees provide a home for them and shade for travelers. It's kind of like that with people too, right? You didn't start out at the size you are right now, did you? No, you started out pretty small. And someday, you know, you're growing and you're going to continue to grow. And someday, hopefully, you'll be able to provide a type of shade to others. It's called hospitality. So when somebody comes walking by where you are, you can extend some comfort on a hot day, maybe a glass of water or a friendly smile, and you can be nice and provide maybe a home or a place to stay for people. Maybe when you get to be moms and dads, you can provide a home for your children. So that all starts with something very little, and it grows, and we're blessed by it. And I hope you are blessed by the people in your lives who provide a home for you, this home and also where you live. So with that, I'll let the song.
Go with my heart, go
you keep it. Yeah, you keep it.
Go
here, I can take it back. Yeah.
We are strong as individuals, but when we combine our talents and resources as a congregation, we can do great works and truly let our beacon shine. Please consider that your contribution helps us further our various social justice interests, serves those in need, and creates a larger, beloved community. You have noticed that the truth comes into this world with two faces. One is sad with suffering, and the other laughs. But it is the same face, laughing or weeping. When people are already in despair, maybe the laughing face is better for them. And when they feel too good and are too sure of being safe, maybe the weeping face is better for them to see. That was from Black Elk Speaks, Being the Life Story of a Holy Man in the Oglala Sioux. Please rise as you are able and join us in singing hymn number 123, Spirit of Life.
Written in C, but we're going to do it in A. A lot friendlier key for some of us.
Spirit of life, come unto me. Sing in my heart all the stirrings of compassion. Blow in the wind, rise in the giving light, the shape of justice, roots wholly close, wings set me free. Spirit of life, come to me, come to me.
Let's hum it once. Don't let your teeth touch each other.
Thank you.
Next, we will hear from Reverend David Jones as he shares with us first a reading and then our message this morning about service learning trips.
Thank you, Michaela. The second reading for this morning comes from Gandhi's autobiography, and it goes like this. Do not worry in the least about yourself. Leave all worry to God. This appears to be the commandment in all religions. This need not frighten anyone. He who devotes himself to service with a clear conscience will day by day grasp the necessity for it in greater measure, and will continually grow richer in faith. The path of service can hardly be trodden by one who is not prepared to renounce self-interest and to recognize the conditions of his birth. Consciously or unconsciously, every one of us does render some service or other. If we cultivate the habit of doing this service deliberately, our desire for service will steadily grow stronger and will make not only for our own happiness, but that of the world at large. It is indeed a joy to be back with you again. I get to the privilege of coming every couple years or so and sharing with this group, and I always look forward to being among friends. And I'm especially elated this morning to have some of the folks from ECM, some of the students that I work with and young people, be here, as well as some of the Mandela scholars as well. And these folks who are here, especially the ones from Africa, are here in Manhattan in large part because of the service that they already render in their home communities. And so I'm looking forward to hearing more from them and from all of you during the talkback session after the message. Well, today I want to visit with you for a few moments about searching for truth through service learning. I hope to leave several minutes at the end of the talk to engage in conversation about the concerns raised, and for the group gathered here this morning to glean from the wisdom that each of you have to share with us. But before we get started, I would like to go over the terms, the definitions, because I know I'm in an academic environment here, so... So truth, what is truth? Simply stated, it's the actual or true state of a matter. In theological seminaries, where I did a good bit of my studying of this sort of thing, there is often much talk of a thing, of a kind of truth called orthodoxy, which is right teaching. And in this particular seminary where I went, there was a lot of talk about orthopraxis, or right action. But this morning I'm more interested in approaching truth from the perspective of orthopathy, which is a term I just recently came across, which is right passion or right emotion or empathy or attitude. The three approaches to truth are complementary, not exclusive, and I suspect that we need aspects of all of them for a vital and sound faith. But in this time of widespread concern over the Brexit vote, is there anything else on news these days? And what it means for international relations and things like immigration, I think it's imperative that we consider orthopathy, which is rooted in love of neighbor and stranger. The other term I want to define is the phrase service learning. Service learning is an educational approach that combines learning objectives with community service in order to provide a pragmatic, progressive learning experience while meeting societal needs. While I was in seminary a long time ago at St. Paul's School of Theology in Kansas City, I encountered service learning in a theological context. The faculty there at the time was fond of what they called the action-reflection model of learning. Are you all familiar with what that is? You go out and engage in an action, and then you come back, and in community you reflect upon that and try to learn from your successes and your failures, and then you integrate that into your thinking, and you go out and practice some more, engage in more direct action, and it's a kind of a continual learning loop and a helpful way, I think, for us to think about growing as human beings and growing in our faith journeys. My application of service learning today derives from the practice that we have at the campus ministry of going on trips during breaks from school, during spring break or winter break, to serve others in need. Now, there's a bit of a difference, I think, also to a distinction between service learning trips and what we used to call mission trips. You know, the mission trips were long ago rooted in a kind of an evangelistic initiative where you'd go out and try to save souls, and you'd go to a different location to that. And there's still some groups, even on campus here, that kind of orient themselves to mission in that way. And then there's this mission trip idea that I grew up with, which is basically you go out and you go out and help people that are in need. And it's typically focused on a disaster relief situation. And it can be, there can be an evangelistic element to that or not. But I'm gonna focus today on service learning and how we implement it, I think, through ECM. But before I go through all that, I want to kind of give you a little bit of background. Some of you know me well, and some not so well. I come from the Christian tradition, and so one of the things that I grew up with was this business about Jesus and his ministry on earth. And basically, Jesus' ministry, which, ministry is a word, by the way, that means to serve. Its root, it means to serve. His ministry on earth consisted of three things primarily: preaching, teaching, and healing. And so that's kind of informs the way that I approach my thinking about ministry and mission and campus ministry. The other thing that deeply informs me is my background as a Mennonite. I have a very ecumenical background. When I was in seminary, they invited us to introduce ourselves in church history class by way of our denominational affiliation, and mine went something like this. I was born in Kansas. Actually, I was born about 300 yards from where I work, over there at the old Riley County Memorial Hospital, when my dad was in vet school. But I was born to parents who were raised in the Church of the Nazarene, and I grew up in a Mennonite community in South Dakota. I went to a Lutheran college, a Methodist seminary, and I worked in a Presbyterian church while I was there. And then I aspired to become a Catholic small C minister, and so I joined the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, which is like First Christian Church here. And so I kind of have this broad broad background. But fundamentally, I think at root, I was informed by that Mennonite upbringing. And there's about five key components of Mennonite spirituality, but one of them is an emphasis on discipleship. And to be a disciple is to be a learner, to be a follower of Jesus, and to kind of learn to walk in the ways of Jesus. And one of the ways that was impressed upon me in a very powerful way was when I was 3 months short of turning 14 years old. I don't know how many of you remember, on June 9th, 1972, there was a 10-inch rain over Spearfish Canyon in the Black Hills of South Dakota. And the storm didn't move, and it poured all that water into a mountain valley, river, that eventually flooded and wiped out a good bit of Rapid City, South Dakota. 244 people lost their lives in that event. And I was just a happy-go-lucky teenager at the time. And I can remember, though, the call went out about a week after the flood for volunteers to go out to Rapid City to help with the cleanup. And I can remember being part of a caravan of five or six busloads, school busloads of people from Freeman, South Dakota, my hometown. And we went out there and we gathered. We stayed in a gymnasium on cots. And the first couple days we went to this woman's home, they had to clear the basement, mind you, of rattlesnakes. They got three of them out before we were allowed to go in and clean. So that always makes an impression on a young teenager. But they had about 20 of us working there, and we spent most of 2 days simply picking up mud out of a basement and putting it in pails and throwing it out the basement window, where there were 10 guys with shovels pulling it away from the house out into the yard. And that was the service we rendered. And I can remember the owner of the house came by the second day. She didn't come up and talk to any of us. She just kind of stood at the street with her two small children and kind of looked at us. And I can remember, thinking to myself, this is what we're called to do as persons of faith and persons of goodwill, is to simply reach out and to help people reclaim their lives when they've been upended. And it made a big impression on me in terms of my own spirituality, about my sense of call into ministry. It just made a big impact on me. This passage that we read from Gandhi, this business about do not worry in the least about yourself, leave all worry to God. That's good advice for 13-year-olds, 16-year-olds, whatever, young people, or neurotics like many of us are, who worry about what people think about or what we're going to be doing for the rest of our lives. Go do something to help one another, another person. It will take your mind off your own troubles and your worries. That's kind of the advice I got when I was a teenager, and I think it's still good advice for all of us. Well, after that experience, I kind of continued to grow up. I got busy, went to college, went to seminary, kind of was doing the whole grad school thing, went into the pastorate. I didn't have a chance to really take time to go do a lot of the kind of work that formed my spirituality. About service learning. And back in the late 90s, my wife Linda had an opportunity to go to Jamaica with some friends of hers from the Methodist Church on a medical mission. And I gave her a hard time because, they picked the toughest time of the year to go to Jamaica, the end of January, right? So they would leave Kansas and go to Jamaica and spend about 9 days, and they did a variety of things. And I used to, enviously refer to her as a vacationary. She would get a vacation from our winters. And fortunately, better wordsmiths than I have taken that concept and turned it into voluntourist, which you might run into that as you read about this sort of thing. That's kind of the critiqued term. A voluntourist is somebody who goes and combines a vacation or tourism with, maybe a few days of helping others in need. So when my kids got a little bit older, when they got to junior high age, I started to take students on mission trips, and we've taken two to Mexico, three to Ecuador, we've gone to Chicago, we've gone to Nashville twice, Texas City, Texas, Port Arthur, Texas a couple times, Louisville, Kentucky, Greensburg, Kansas, and then most recently to Pine Ridge in South Dakota. And, those trips have a lot of value, not only to those who are in need, all the work that's delivered, but there's also, in the best cases, some relationship building that goes on with hosts. I think one of the things that made me back off of my critique of my wife was that over time, she kept going every year, right? So it wasn't a one-and-done sort of thing. She was building relationships. And so some of those people began to call her, and they would correspond, and And there's been some visiting from Jamaica back and forth. So so relationships built, and that's over time, and that's really good. There's value to the young people. Typically, it's young people that go on these trips with me, and that's a tremendous experience for Midwestern young people who have never maybe been out of the Midwest or not much out of the Midwest to experience a different culture, a different language, to feel what it's like to be a racial minority. Those are all tremendous learning experiences. And it's always better, I think, to be in a situation where you're helping others, and rather than just being going to the resorts, or you kind of get out into the real part of the countries you're visiting and get a better experience. And again, and there's also value again in finding yourself by losing yourself in service to others, kind of that concept I was talking about a minute ago. I think there's a good many young people have found their vocation, as I did in one sense, or was at least informed about my vocation by engaging in this kind of mission work. And then there's the whole ecumenical approach. You know, we don't seem to do very well among different denominations or different faiths when we try to talk about or try to find agreement on things that we think about. And so a lot of division in that regard. So, but there's one thing that we can come together and not fight about things typically. It's about helping other people. And so service learning trips are a way of being ecumenical in a world that doesn't agree rationally, intellectually with one another very well. So I always thought that this was a wonderful way to go about doing ecumenical work. And then there's always the group building that goes on when students, you know, a group of people go and spend a week or 2 weeks together in intense community. There's friendships that are formed that last a lifetime, and wonderful conversations around meal tables and campfires and over work breaks when you're sweating profusely somewhere. So those are all some of the valuable things. And, you know, I was kind of sailing along with this whole good, you know, service learning trips are a good thing until about a year ago. I got an invitation from a young professor at the School of Leadership Studies at Kansas State University by the name of Eric Hartman. And Eric has done a lot of research on service learning, and he has a website called, I think it's slglobal.org or something like that. That's kind of his focus. And what he did last August was they brought together about 40 people from all over the world who are involved in mission agencies in different kinds of settings. So probably 20, 25 different countries represented, healthcare settings, children's orphanage settings, all different kinds of things, all different kinds of work. And they came together at Kansas State University and had this conversation about how to do service learning well. And there's a lot of ways to do service learning poorly. and I heard some of them. And some of this was kind of new to me. For example, they said, don't go somewhere and do children's work. Don't go in there for a week or 2 weeks and make wonderful bonds with young children, and then just leave right away. Does that help those children long term? Yeah, that makes, there's some sense to that. There's another story I read. There's a writer and a board member for the travel nonprofit organization called Onwards, her name is Pippa Biddle, and she wrote in a viral, this essay's gone viral. She describes a project in which she and some other volunteers spent a week helping to build a library, only to discover how ineffective and counterproductive their work was. This is a quote from her. "Turns out that we, a group of highly educated board school students were so bad at the most basic construction work that each night the men in the community had to take down the structurally unsound bricks that we had laid and rebuilt the structure so that when we woke up in the morning, we would be unaware of our failure. Good intentions gone awry. And then the one that was the real kicker for me was, I think she was, at the time, she's now about 35 years old, but at the time she was a 23-year-old med student. I think, does Harvard have a med school? I think so. I'm sure they do, right? So she was a second-year med student, I think, at Harvard, and she went on this service learning trip somewhere in Africa, I'm sure, and she's gone to observe this, you know, operations and doctors and that sort of thing, and they were working on a young person who, a young boy, who had some kind of spinal condition, and at some point, they were in the middle of a surgery, and the surgeon turned to her and said, "Okay, go ahead and take over from here." You know, she was like, you know, she wasn't equipped to do it and botched. I think it was a spinal tap. Something like that, where she was asked to perform a part of the operation. It didn't go well. The patient ended up dying, and she's carried this guilt around for 12 years. And part of her reason for coming to this conference was to say, don't let medical students from the United States go to other countries and practice on people there. That's not the right way to do, you know, medical education. And we've got to get away from that. Well, there's some problems with doing that. And I guess going to that conference, you know, it kind of opened my eyes to some of the bad ways that, you know, and I knew there were bad ways of doing, I knew evangelicals did mission poorly. You know, when you'd go in and look for spiritual scalps to claim and not ever build a relationship necessarily with the person that you were witnessing to. But I hadn't really thought about it too much in terms of the kinds of mission trips that we had been engaged in. But this whole experience caused me to kind of rethink how we do service learning. At the same time, as much as I appreciated the admonitions that came out of that conference, I chafed a little bit at the nanny state. Here's my Tea Partyism. I'm not a Tea Partier, but there's a sense here, this business about them. They had this experience, and they were trying to say, don't do it. Don't, you know, kind of protecting everybody from, well, there's a bit of wisdom to that, but it's also kind of a bit of arrogance to say, okay, you had the chance to make your own mistakes. Why are you going to take that away from a new generation of young people? I mean, they can certainly learn from your mistakes, but it's throwing cold water on certain kinds of service learning tends to dampen the enthusiasm for the whole enterprise. And so I think we kind of have to be careful a little bit about how we critique some of this activity. I think we have to, everybody wants to protect their children, and in this case we need to protect other people's children. But the reality is also that we have to also let people out and young people experience and explore and make their own mistakes in their own way in the world. So there's a balance there that I'm personally still trying to find the right balance for us. And there was also a concern for me that came out of that conference and had been growing since we had taken three trips to Ecuador, and that was a concern about cost and investment. And so the question came to me, would it make more sense for us, because, well, let me back up. When we went to Ecuador, we took usually about 20 people, and we typically would raise in the range of $35,000 to $40,000 for those 20 or 22 people. And $23,000 or $4,000 of that was tied up in airfare. So once you got to Ecuador, it was very inexpensive to to be sustained, but getting there was terrifically expensive. So it occurred to me, you know, would it make more sense to raise a similar amount of money and send it along with a smaller crew of people from ECM to engage our hosts and to monitor the use of the funds, but to use that airfare to hire people from the local communities, which would actually generate, now Michael, you can help me, is this how this works? You know, where you invest money in communities and give people jobs, and then there's a multiplier effect, and it actually helps. It's a better way of sustaining the community than for 20 foreigners to come in, drop some of our expertise and our work, and then we're out, right? So yeah, I've been thinking about that sort of thing, and especially it depends on what kind of work we're doing. The last year we went to Ecuador, we almost all of us engaged in trench digging. Okay, so they had 7 schools in this community, and none of the schools had running water, and they wanted to get running water to the schools, so we would dig trenches, and we dug trenches for about 8 days straight, and 20 of us, and the people there would work alongside of us. They'd work twice as fast and hard as we were because they were used to working hard. But, you know, we could have hired 10 or 20, you know, locals to do that kind of work, and that money would have circulated, and it would have been their project. They would have owned it, and that sort of thing. So what's the most sustainable course of action? There's a quote, and I don't know if I have it here. I didn't put it in the bulletin, but it's by Robert Greenleaf, who wrote several books on servant leadership. And this is, I think, an important concept to get across. The servant leader is a servant first. Becoming a servant leader begins with the natural feeling that one wants to serve first. Then conscious choice begins one to aspire to lead. Now that person is sharply different from one who is leader first. The difference manifests itself in the care taken by the servant first to make sure that other people's highest priority needs are being served. The best test and the most difficult to administer is this: do those persons served grow as persons? Do they, while being served, become healthier, wiser, freer, more autonomous, and more likely themselves to become servants? That should be, I think, the true measure of how well we are doing with our service learning projects. The question is always, are we really contributing to the well-being of the community when we go into these places with our good intentions? If we're uneducated about the culture and the problems that we're of the places where we're volunteering, then I don't think we're really doing a good service to that community or to ourselves. So what are some of the keys to doing service learning well? Well, I think, one, having an established partner in the community that you're going is an excellent first step. It's not, so you're working with people that know that community, know the problems, know the culture. We're not just exporting our American expertise and wisdom into that setting. Secondly, it's important to train community partners to sustain the gains and continue building capacity. That kind of goes back to what I was talking about with hiring people. Another way of, I know another group that they'll go in and install clean water filtration systems. And the literature's filled with stories about Americans, mission groups going in and installing stuff that just goes to pot because nobody knows how to maintain it, how to keep it going, and how to, you know, continue to build upon that. So training local partners is critically important. And then another key thing is to kind of flip the script a little bit. When we go places, instead of us bringing American values and culture into a place, that we take some time to to bring in the elders of that community or the young people of that community and to hear stories about the problems and the challenges and the dreams of that culture. And I think that's kind of the direction that I would like to continue to move in. I think we do a pretty good job at ECM. I know a lot of groups struggle with different parts of this, and we do as well. But we just got back from, like I said, Pine Ridge, the Indian Reservation in southwest South Dakota, and Hannah was one of the students that went with me, and it was a powerful experience. But I think one of the things that I really liked about the way that they did that experience is the first day we went in and toured, went to Wounded Knee first day, the Badlands, saw all that good land that the American government graciously donated to the Indians, you know, that they could grow crops on and that sort of thing. Wounded Knee was just, I'm still trying to process the feelings that I had when I went to that place. So we had this tour day, and then we went out and did work projects. We put skirting on trailer homes. Now remember, these are trailer homes that originated when FEMA gave them to the flood victims in New Orleans 10 years ago, and they poisoned people there with their formaldehyde. And then they went to Greensburg, probably different with trailers, but they made people sick in Greensburg, Kansas after the tornado in 2008. Well, then those trailers don't die. They end up going to places like Pine Ridge where they're given to folks and to families because there's such a tremendous shortage of housing. And people have to, you know, they're told, be thankful that you have a better place to live than what you currently have. And so, but these places, these trailers don't have insulated skirting around them, so we would build some skirting to help with the utility costs and that sort of thing. But then about 3 or 4 days into the trip, one of our other students, Carly, and I were having a conversation, and I said, now you realize that the mission of this trip, the mission of the organization that's hosting us is not that we do work for the Native Americans. You realize we're the mission. It's to change our hearts. It's to change our minds. It's to motivate us to speak about the injustices that are going on and to try to work toward changes that will actually be helpful to the people who live there and to support their efforts to change their world. That was the mission. And I think so when you can connect with a group like that that does a tremendous job of educating not only of educating the people, the missionaries, the service learning workers, I think that's the way to go. So in my mind, that's the truth towards which I am moving in my thinking on service learning. So with that, I'm going to close. And if do you want me to just lead if there's questions or comments? I think Kathleen has the microphone. Just raise your hand, and once she gets it to you, you'll have the floor.
I have several comments, but I won't make them all. But two things. Many years ago, when I announced I was going to go to Nicaragua, I was working in the local hospital, and very soon after that, Dr. Leland Wrights very seriously sat me down and gave me a lecture. And it was actually very helpful, and I was very surprised. But what he said was, don't think you know the best way to do things just because you're from the United States and have an education. And he told me stories. He had worked in Vietnam opening an orphanage and had learned a lot. And he was just very concerned that I go with the attitude of didn't always know the right way to do things. He proved to be very right. It was hard to hold my tongue at times, but that's true. But my other question is, have you tracked at all the long-term effects of these trips on the students that go with you? I don't mean how they feel a month later, but what has been the long-term effects on their life?
Short-term response is no. I mean, everything would be anecdotal. I haven't done any systematic kinds of tracking of that. Just by conversation and when people... one of the things that I've seen is that, I mean, and maybe the, what I don't know is whether these trips contributed to that or whether students have, they go on these trips, have a greater sense of calling to service, personal service, or internationalism. But it certainly is something that reinforces those particular types of calling. But it's a great, I mean, we should probably be doing that.
Jim Chanteau. I really appreciated your talk today. Is this song? Okay. It just brought back lots of memories. When I was a junior in college, I was studying mechanical engineering and went on a Catholic student-sponsored trip to the Central Highlands of Mexico, in part because I had skills as an engineer that might be useful for the group. I went down there for 2 summers. When I came back, I was no longer an engineer. I became a psychologist. So that's one answer to the long-term impact.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's also, you mentioned the impact it has on the people that go. And I certainly observed that, not only myself, but almost everybody that went down on those trips came back a different person. But I wanted to make another comment about the unexpected consequences of unanticipated consequences of these sorts of trips. At the end of the second summer I was down there, I was talking to one of the local women in town who had gotten to know and asked her what she thought about the Norte Americanos who were there for these summers. And I thought she would say, well, you did, you know, you built ditches, you know, we did the same sort of thing you did. We also tried to provide some health care services, things like that. She didn't talk about that at all. Hmm. What she said is that most of the year, this village is muy triste. It's very sad. Children die, people aren't doing well, we're sick. But when you're here, muy feliciado, it's very happy. The reason is you're so silly. You do so many dumb things, that's all we can talk about.
That's funny.
And I thought, well, you know, that's not why we went down there. But, of course, she was absolutely right. We did so many dumb things.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally, you know, we thought we were smart. We were college students.
Right.
But in their eyes, we were doing everything wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But they got a laugh out of it. So, you know, there was, for a couple of months out of the year, they were a happy village.
That's awesome. That's fun.
Yeah. I'm Mary Hooper. I'm visiting in Kansas this summer. I have a 20-year-old grandson that is, excuse me, a frog. Allergies. I have a 20-year-old grandson that is in the Naval Cadets at A&M College, located in Galveston, Texas. Part of their curriculum is traveling on boats in the summertime. They have to get in at least an all-summer cruise. They call them a cruise. They certainly are not the kind that I think about cruises. But this year, he is on the naval ship called Mercy. That ship is has the doctors, the nurses, the dentists, all the medical people that are in the Navy. And they are called out. They have a Mercy ship in the Atlantic, and they have one in the Pacific. Last year, he was on the ship in the Atlantic, but this year, he's on the Pacific Ocean. They have just left an island of Indonesia. My son's job was running the boat from the Mercy ship, which has to be 3 miles out in the ocean because of the threats to Americans. Yet they're there to help the people that need medical help. They go to places like when there was the tsunami and they went to Miramar and helped there. Our naval ships does a lot of work like that, and I had no idea. I did not even know about this. But the thing that worries him was that they were there for 12 days, and he ran the boat between the shore where the people were waiting to be taken out for medical services. He would take them then to the ship. Once they had their treatment, you know, he takes them back, and this is what he's doing. He told me by text message when they were leaving Tamar that what upset him were the hundreds that were still there waiting to be helped when their schedule said they had to move.
Hi, Linda Kreger. I'm going to put some of the students on the spot because I think some of you may have done one of these trips. If any of you want to tell us what it's like from your perspective.
Chu will.
My name's Hannah Minson. I went with David on the most recent trip to South Dakota. It was a very powerful and moving experience, not only getting to know the other students that came on the trip, because it wasn't just Kansas State University students that went, but students from all over the U.S. that came, but also listening to the elders in the community speak about the struggles that the people on the reservation faced, and their culture and their practices, and going around the reservation and seeing the FEMA trailers that definitely should not have been in use, and hearing about the impact that the organization we went with was having on these people's utility bills. The crew I worked with also planted a community garden that would be feeding people later in the year, just because they don't have access to fresh vegetables and fruit. So that was a very powerful and moving experience. And listening and talking to the residents, they definitely told us about the difference that we made and how they were so thankful. And I definitely made connections and friendships that will last a very long time. So it was wonderful to go, and it was wonderful to be with an organization that put such an emphasis on the learning aspect of the trip. I think that made quite a difference in the trip.
Yeah. Well, I work for a pediatric hospital, as I said, which is based in Zambia. We're part of a huge family of hospitals. So most of our donations actually come from the United States. I write content, and I highlight all the children that are admitted. And out of this work, people can read about our stories and read about our children and donate. And they're also we have a lot of huge churches, mostly, that donate to our cause. But I want to specifically talk about the missions. What happens is that we have mostly college students and people from churches who come almost maybe 10 times a year to our hospital, and they spend time probably sometimes 3 days or a week, then of course go on holiday. And for me personally, I find that such trips do not really help our patients in the way that they should help them, because we appreciate every donation, but if somebody comes to the hospital and spends a week doing absolutely nothing but painting and maybe reading to the children who do not even speak English, and feeling in a better position because of the suffering they see. For me, that sometimes depresses me. And they're given tours, which are set up right here, of the hospital, and they're given tours of our city, which do not highlight the truth, you know. They take them all to the most impoverished parts of the city and the country, and they take them for outreach in the village, which is absolutely not what's happening. So you find that, like what you were saying, they spend close to $60,000 on transportation, and they come and live in the nice hotels and donate maybe $2,000 to $3,000. And at the end of the day, you wonder what type of ministry is going on if people are feeling better about themselves. And at the end of the day, you spend 80% of your time taking photographs of these kids from surgery. Because you donate money, you're given the opportunity to stand in with a surgeon and watch someone's life at your mercy. And for me, I always try to write stories that do not just highlight suffering, but highlight the positivity that our children have, so that if people are donating and they're interested in coming to see the hospital, it's good that they come and see an actual picture, a picture of faith, hope, and love, and not just suffering. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Katie Kingery Page. I'm faculty in the College of Architecture, Planning, and Design, so I do some certain amount of service learning with students. What we bring in terms of expertise has to do with design, so we're doing that kind of work. And I just want to ask you, Reverend Jones, I had the privilege of making my own mistakes all over the world and the country as a young person, as you mentioned. So for me as a faculty, this will be a long-winded question, but it'll end with a question. I think I have sort of a quiet agenda of actually wanting my students to learn about their own identity by understanding more of local conditions. For example, you know, many of my students come from the Midwest, and they come from fairly affluent backgrounds, so they might think that there's one way to be a Midwesterner or a Kansan, whereas I could sum it up in one sentence. I live in Manhattan, and if I want to talk with people living in abject poverty, all I have to do is actually cross the street from my house. Yeah. So I wonder what your thoughts are on encouraging service learning locally, within the state, in terms of the personal growth of the individual, versus in other places, which involves maybe some of those traps of thinking of people as other.
Right. That's kind of why... I got some encouragement from my board of directors that we should stay within the United States, because there's, I mean, and that's how we ended up going to Pine Ridge. We actually sent a group about 5 years ago. I wasn't able to go on that trip, but it was a kind of a return trip, and I went this time, and we will be going back. If you want to see abject poverty, you know, that's a place. 2 million acres, they have one grocery store in. For all that, I mean, they've got shop and go, you know, quick trip things, but one grocery store, they've got all kinds of, I mean, there's 85 to 90% unemployment. They've got free housing, but they've also got 538 government programs that create dependency. They're supposed to help, but create dependency. And even the group that I worked with, or that we worked with, the organization, I think there's tribal policy. I mean, there's all kinds of things, and there's no way that anybody like me or any of us could go in there for a few days and say, oh, this is what they need to do, sort of thing. It's a situation where you kind of have to live with them and try to kind of walk alongside them. You know, I have some questions about whether the group that we worked with is, if they're extending the dependency, or if there should be more emphasis. Like, there's some other groups on the reservation that are focused on developing entrepreneurialism and home ownership and that kind of thing. But again, the laws are so, the tribal sovereignty was overlaid by the federal governments, and it is the biggest mess I've ever seen. It's a mess. So there's plenty of, I guess the answer is there's plenty of poverty to engage here. There's plenty of injustice. I still think it's valuable for that international experience, but I think we have to do it, you know, looking at all these issues that we're talking about, and try to be as intentional about doing it well as we can.
I'm going to possibly be the final comment. Who knows? And I find it slightly ironic that Kathleen's telling me it's time when time was what I wanted to talk about. So I think I really appreciate the thoughts everybody shared today. And I think the thing that I just keep kicking around is Americans are so focused on time, and you want to go and have this life-changing experience in 2 days. And just how realistic is that? And it's been echoing around in my head for the past 10 years. I took a public administration class, and there was a case study about a conflict between governments and a Native American tribe in the south, in the northwest somewhere, and that all of the meetings were tried to run through Robert's Rule of Order. And the Native Americans were saying, there is no space for us in your rules of order. You need to come and spend time with us to understand what the rivers mean to us and what the lands mean to us. And you're trying to push through this stuff as quickly as possible because that's your culture. And so when I think of the Peace Corps, I think of people that go and stay embedded and are trying to build sustainable things. And I think a lot of these issues have to do with time. Mm-hmm. So that's my thought.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for your great discussion. We usually try to wrap it by noon. We're a couple minutes behind. Michael, shall we just skip it?
I have been working on this thing all week. We are not going to skip
okay.
it.
Okay. I apologize. Our closing hymn is Blue Boat Home in the Teal Hymnal.
The accompaniment bears no resemblance to the hymnal. I use the conventional hymnal version to go with this hymn. All right.
It's number 1064.
It's going to be in the key of D.
Though below me I feel no motion, standing on these mountains and plains, far away from the rolling ocean, still my trial heart can say. I've been sailing all my life now, never harbor or port have I known. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue boat home. Sun my sail and moon my rudder, as I ply the starry sea. Over the edge and wander, casting questions into the deep. Drifting here with my shy companions, all our kindred pilgrim souls, making our way by the light of the Jordan in our beautiful blue boat home. I give thanks to the waves upholding me, hail the great winds urging me on. The infinite sea before me, sing the sky my sailor's song. I was born across the fathoms, never harbor or port have I known. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue boat home.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for being here, and I hope that you've had some stimulating ideas to think about and continue with that through your day. And
go in peace and serve to the best of your ability, being led by the Spirit.
Thank you.